Hey, everybody. Mike Malloy here. Thanks for tuning in. Welcome to tonight's program. Laura Flanders is going to join us in about an hour. Stick around for a conversation with her. Remember, she was scheduled, about a month ago and had an emergency come up, couldn't make it. I guess as a result of last night's program, I'm not sure, we received here at the Malloy program some really vile emails. Two of them we are going to post in their entirety, including the email addy, the person who sent, the two people who sent it. I want you to read this when we get it up, because I think it'll give you an indication of how sick people really, really can be. The one with the comments about our five-year-old daughter is just beyond belief, but they'll be there for your perusal if you care to do that. Greg in Florida, just a few minutes ago, I got this from him, and he said, Mike, this is unbelievable. There may be up to three separate oil leaks in the Gulf, as well as 3 weeks instead of one at the Deepwater Horizon site. You get that? Deepwater Horizon, there may be three leaks there, but there are three more. Sorry to send this so soon before the program, but I just found it. I hope you're already aware of it. Well, the one I am, it comes from the a Mobile, Alabama press register, and it was posted late last night at their online site and written by Ben Raines. An excerpt here: the Deepwater Horizon is not the only well leaking oil into the Gulf of Mexico. For the last month, a nearby drilling rig, the Ocean Saratoga, has been leaking since at least April 30th, according to a federal document. While the leak is decidedly smaller than the Deepwater Horizon spill, a 10-mile-long slick emanating from the Ocean Saratoga is visible from space in multiple images gathered by SkyTruth.org, which monitors environmental problems using satellites. And then from TheAtlantic.com, the Atlantic magazine, this is from their website. Here's an excerpt. John Amos, head of the West Virginia-based nonprofit SkyTruth.org, was looking at satellite images of the oil from the Deepwater Horizon site when he noticed what appeared to be another small slick of about 11 miles, a small slick of oil about 11 miles off the coast of Louisiana, about 40 miles from the major spill. That would mean there are potentially two other operations in the Gulf leaking oil. So just how common are such leaks? The sad reality is we don't know. Right now, oil companies are required by law to report any spills to the National Response Center, Coast Guard, or Environmental Protection Agency if there is a, quote, visible sheen, end quote. Oil companies report spilling roughly 1.3 million gallons of oil into U.S. waterways in an average year, but that figure is largely reliant on self-reporting. The government trusts that operators are following the law and reporting all of the spills, Mr. Amos says. Yeah, of course they are. Of course they're reporting all the spills. I was talking to a friend today about this catastrophe. It is not, it can only be described now as a catastrophic event in the Gulf of Mexico. And he said, well, it was nice that you were able to take your children there when it was still what it is, what it's going to stop being within the next few weeks. And I said, yeah, We have lots of photographs and lots of video, because it was an incredible place to take children for a week in the summer, every summer, sometimes a week in the winter. I don't think there's been a season that we've not spent at least 4 or 5 days, if not a week, on St. George's Island or Cape San Blas, which is in the Florida Panhandle, what they used to call the Forgotten Coast, because the images that you're seeing of in Panama City and some of those areas don't do justice to the coast further east, where the sand dunes are and the schools of porpoises that swim by. And it's just all the way over to Apalachicola Bay. It's hard to envision that this now is over, but it is. A couple of emails Mike, Dr. Mike writes, "Yo, Mike, as quiet as it's kept, the longest running American war," because I said last night that the war in Afghanistan, or I said the other night, had become the longest running American war. Dr. Mike says, "As quiet as it's kept, the longest running American war was that against the Native Americans, which ran from 1492 to about 1910. Don't get it twisted, boss. Stay in their asses." Dr. Mike. My apologies. That's true. Bill in Hayward, Wisconsin, reminds me that 43 years ago today, Israeli Navy and Air Forces attacked the USS Liberty in international waters off the coast of Israel, killed 34 American sailors and wounded 237. Helen Thomas and the rest of the media did not report this tragedy, and the media still does not talk or write about it. All the information you need is at Google. Just type in USS Liberty. P.S. I've been a listener forever. Yeah, 43 years ago during the 67 war, and nobody ever said anything or asked for prosecution. Also, 61 years ago today, George Orwell's classic 1984 was published. June 8th, 1949. I don't care if Rush Limbaugh gets married 30 times. I don't care if he drives himself blind with his drug usage or has a pimple on his ass that keeps him out of the military. Rush Limbaugh's miserable, twisted life is none of my business. But to find out that Elton John, who has been a strong advocate of gay rights and a strong advocate of assisting people with AIDS, raising millions of dollars for AIDS, and then playing at the wedding, playing his music, taking his music to a wedding of an AIDS denier and a major homophobe, is beyond belief. I think it's very clear that Elton John's price is $1 million. For $1 million, Elton John will suck up to a human being who has very tenuous claim to that title, but who has gone out of his way to demean people dying of this horrible disease for the past 20 years. Rush Limbaugh is a vile human being. I doubt if there's any debate about that anywhere on earth, unless you're deluded. But for Elton John, I think from this point on, I'm sorry, but I just am not going to be able to play Elton John music on this program anymore. Help me remember that, Kathy, because I always liked his music. But to sell his own ass for $1 million to a piece of human waste like Rush Limbaugh. Astonishing. There's a little blog here from Daily Coast written by Karen Backman entitled Cheney's Great Dismal Swamp of Death. Now, you know, when somebody sends me something like that, you know, with a title like that, I've got to read it, and I felt it was good enough that I'm going to read it. Well, we got a break here, but as soon as we come back from this break, I'm going to read this. Cheney's Great Dismal Swamp of Death. And you know what she's referring to? She's referring to the, the Gulf of Mexico. So we'll share that with you as soon as we come back after the break. We have a lot of stuff tonight to get to, none of which is very happy or pleasant at all. And, I don't know what to say, except, we just report and talk about this stuff. We certainly don't come up with it. I wish I could talk about nice, pleasant things. I wish there were some other than, like I said the other night, focus on your family, your spouse, your kids, your nieces, your nephews, your grandkids, and I guess do that, right? We'll be right back.
I looked to the children, I drank on standing up to the flying monkey right. It's Mike Malloy.
Just a little comedic footnote, I guess. The so-called rabbi who brought down Helen Thomas, according to RaceWire.org, Channing Kennedy writing there, he had a website that he has now taken down, but the video that he and one of his friends put together called Holy Weather treats Mexicans. This is a rabbi. This is the rabbi. This is why I find it a little bit hard to believe that this clown is really a rabbi. Anyway, the video is from February of this year in which Rabbi Nesenoff dons a terrible Mexican impression and makes a lot of jokes about being detained by immigration enforcement. And as Channing Kennedy writes, you've got a stronger stomach than me if you can make it past the one about being a dishwasher. We've posted it, didn't we? Have you got it up? Have you got it up, Kathy? You've got it posted where people can go take a look. If you go to MikeMalloy.com, you can see it. It's pretty gross and it's very amateurish, but this is the guy who brought down Helen Thomas. And also, as long as we're talking about ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, officials from that agency have been targeting BP job sites. Are you ready? You know why they're there. They're going out to the job sites that this filthy capitalist gang has established for the cleanup. And the immigration officials have been going to job sites in Louisiana to hunt for undocumented workers who are risking their lives to clean up this disastrous oil spill. El Diario La Prensa and another program called Feet in Two Worlds, a public radio investigative journalism project, broke the story today. A spokesperson for ICE, Temple Black, confirmed the report. Here's what it says. ICE, Branch Department of Homeland Security, visited two command centers, one in Venice and the other in Hopedale, Louisiana, twice in May. ICE agents arrived at the staging areas without prior notice, rounded up workers, asked for documentation of their legal status. The command centers, located in the marshes a few hours east of New Orleans, are among the largest, with hundreds of workers employed at each site. Temple Black, a nice spokesperson said, quote, "We don't normally go and check people's papers. We're mostly focused on transnational gangs, predators, drugs. This was a special circumstance because of the oil spill," end quote. Now, this is a part where I should normally say, son of a bitch, but I'm trying to stop that, so I won't say it. There are no arrests at either site, according to the ICE spokesman. But, he said, if undocumented workers had been discovered, they would have been detained on the spot and taken to Orleans Parish Prison. Workers report that federal officials showed up in unmarked cars and out of uniform. Mr. Black insisted, quote, "These weren't raids, they were investigations," end quote. End quote. They certainly weren't investigations into worker safety. As Color Lines, Julianne Hing reported Tuesday, BP has not only failed to provide proper training and hazmat gear for workers braving its toxic stew, it has also threatened to fire workers who use their own protective gear provided by the Louisiana Environmental Action Network. But if ICE spokesperson Black is to be believed, federal oversight is more concerned with scapegoating immigrant workers for the region's downward spiraling economy. Mr. Black, the spokesman for ICE in Louisiana, said, quote, "We visited just to ensure that people who are legally here can compete for those jobs. Those people who are having so many problems," end quote. Department of Homeland Security and the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, always there to protect America. Well, I blew right past Cheney's dismal swamp of death, great dismal swamp of death. So we'll do it as soon as we come back from the next break. I'm still just a little stunned about the email about Molly. I'm sorry. I just, you know, I'm pretty much immune to a lot of this stuff, and a lot of it I don't read. But everyone's well, somebody will really ring my chimes, and you know, of course, I get all my whites of my eyes turn red, and I start to breathe fire and smoke. And I know if I could get my hands around the bastard's throat, I'd squeeze until he couldn't breathe anymore. But I'll get over it during this break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Could have died if I wanted to, slipped over the edge and drowned. But oh no, babe, I won't give up that easy, no. Too many time tracks in the sands of time. Too many love affairs that stop on a dime. Well, oh babe, I think it's time to make some change.
Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. So, I get an email today from a listener who also writes for Daily Kos, Karen Backman. The title of this piece she sent, very quick, Cheney's Great Dismal Swamp of Death. Well, when I see the word Cheney and the word death in the same sentence, you know, it gets my attention because he is the death meister. He wants to kill everything on the planet so that when he finally kicks off, he, you know, has some place to go. This is what Karen wrote. Gloating, he hovers over the Gulf of Mexico, his oil-grimed black wings sinuously flapping. Eldest daughter gleefully yapping at his ankles. For the moment, they are strangely silent. After months of constant presence on accommodating American television, showboating on Fox, one hopes that they might at last be experiencing guilt and shame. But no. They are momentarily stunned by the awesomeness of their success. Slightly savoring the sight of their spoils, dying pelicans dripping crude oil on the beaches, whitening and fouling corpses of fish, sea mammals, all manner of dead creatures brought to life by the seas and felled by the U.S. Supreme Court strengthened arm of the almighty corporation. Could it be so glorious, this great victory? The total victory of corporate will over mere feeble mortal humanity. Immortal corporatism shall live on and on and on, decimating all living creatures, even humanity. Cheney bows down to his superior being, the Antichrist, the corporation British Petroleum PLC, and receives for his labors a crude oil-begrimed halo. A black-robed Greek chorus of five furiously claps. Cheney's loyal claque. Scalia, Roberts, Alito, Thomas, and Kennedy. All those secret meetings, poring over a table-wide map of Iraq, who could have known that the territorial take would also include a vast body of water, the Gulf of Mexico. Sweet. Too sweet. Meanwhile, younger daughter Mary colluding with a mysterious ex-aide to the witch-like Jean Schmidt of Ohio is forming yet another right-wing tank of destruction to democracy. The Alliance for America's Future. Karen Hedwig Blackman, writing at Daily Kos. It's very poetic, Karen. It's very good. I like that. I may be 180 degrees wrong yet again, on this time on Elton John. Sue writes, I too was appalled to hear Elton John playing at the Big Boy's wedding. I learned from a fellow news junkie, however, that all the proceeds from Elton's private performance goes to his AIDS Foundation. Thinking of 1 million of Big Boy's dollars being used for Elton John's AIDS Foundation, not so bad, Sue. Okay. Well, Sue, if you can find any confirmation of that, please let me know, because I do like his music, and Elton John has more money than the pig man. Well, he did it all, perhaps, to Kathy wants to know, to get $1 million from the pig man to give to AIDS Foundation work. All right. And this, things are all topsy-turvy. Senator Dianne Feinstein, who is Jewish, today called for, quote, an impartial inquiry, end quote, into the Israeli commando raid on the humanitarian flotilla carrying aid to the Gaza that left 9 activists dead, including one American. That was an American citizen, Turkish-born American citizen. He was 19 years old when the Israelis executed him. The California Democrat, one of Israel's most dependable supporters on Capitol Hill, also urged Israel to, quote, reassess, end quote, its, quote, forced isolation, end quote, of the Gaza Strip, and allow more humanitarian assistance and other materials to reach its beleaguered Palestinian population. Feinstein said in a statement, quote, there should be an impartial inquiry to determine exactly what took place, end quote. Turkey and other critics charge that Israel used disproportionate force to prevent the activists from running the blockade. Yada, 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 yada. Feinstein said, quote, Israel's forced isolation of Gaza, along with Hamas's refusal to recognize Israel's right to exist, are the roots of this tense situation, end quote. See, there they go again. Nobody can ever criticize Israel for anything without dragging up some kind of equivalence. No matter how weak, no matter how fragile, by God, they must present the equivalence. Well, Feinstein, who chairs the Senate Intelligence Committee, with her call for this investigation, stands in sharp contrast to those of most other lawmakers who have sided with Israel in the incident. From Kathleen, Mike, my husband and I often listen to your show. We are paying for a paid subscription as we need to have you saying truth to power. Sorry we haven't subscribed sooner, but my husband is on permanent disability and I am the main breadwinner, making $35,000 per year. However, with this unfolding apocalypse in the Gulf, I can no longer stand aside and not fight back against the corporatists, including Obama, who have taken over our country. The fact that Obama, the commander-in-chief, supposedly has admitted that he has not even picked up the phone to give Hayward, the CEO of BP, a piece of his mind, shows that we are totally under the control of corporations. He is nothing but a front man for big oil, the military-industrial torture conglomerate, etc., etc. I cannot put into words the anger and frustration I have over this man. We sent him $350 during his campaign, knocked on doors, made phone calls, hoping against hope that we had a once-in-a-generation leader. Instead, he has turned out to be another corporate shill. We have been conned, I heard Daniel Ellsberg say. As the Gulf of Mexico dies, I cannot stand idly by. The Cajun way of life and wildlife is being destroyed, and Obama really seems to give a shrug. I am subscribing to Peter B. Collins as well. Keep it going. With the press being censored by BP and Obama silent on that, we need you guys more than ever. Kathleen.
I heard a pundit earlier today make a comment about Obama's lack of contact with the BP executives, and they made a kind of a salient point, because if Obama is going to order Holder or anyone in the Justice Department to initiate an investigation, he can't really speak to these people, I mean, any more than he already has. And the idea was that, now this could just be political cover, but that behind the scenes, Obama's saying, we have to kind of limit our contact with these people because we may be handing down criminal indictments. They're on the opposite side at this point.
You know what?
Can't work with them.
You know what? I get so tired of that legal mumbo jumbo.
Well, it could be true.
Well, it may be, but I'm saying I just get very tired of that crap. An entire section of the northern western hemisphere is being destroyed by a capitalist organization that knew, apparently, new documents are surfacing now, knew full well that they were putting everything at risk and just didn't care. This is how capitalism or corporatism works. I am not denying my part in this disaster, because I still drive a gasoline-burning vehicle. So, and when you multiply my pickup truck by 100 million vehicles in this country, or more, that's part of the problem. But for a corporation like BP to consciously and deliberately set in motion what turned out to be a chain of events that is destroying the Gulf of Mexico is beyond my ability to kind of parse it with legalese and say, well, he can't call him and he can't call him and so on and so forth. We'll be right back.
Fun and frivolity with Mike Malloy.
Ten before the hour, very quickly here from Prairie 2 regarding ICE. This is a situation in Louisiana where ICE is actually doing its job. BP has been rumored to be hiring illegals and not giving them protective gear or training, with the idea that they won't ever report their illness and their deaths won't be noticed. Okay, but why then is it incumbent upon the spokesman for ICE to say, if we find any without papers, we're going to take them immediately to the New Orleans prison? But I get your point, Bruce. Okay. Another correction from last night. I said that somebody sent me an email and said that Representative Charles Schumer, or Senator Charles Schumer, was one of the signatories to PNAC. And in the moment, of course, I didn't check it. I didn't research it. I just went with the email. So a correction here today from Joro, okay. Regarding last night's Schumer reference, I'm sure you got a bunch of these. Actually, I didn't. You're the only one who wrote. Senator Charles Schumer has never signed any PNAC document. He's on the board of advisors for the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. As SourceWatch indicates, that's really not any better. What company Schumer can keep is disgusting, but it's not PNAC. Now, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. In early 2001, a tightly knit group of billionaire philanthropists conceived of a plan to win American sympathy for Israel's response to the Palestinian Intifada. They believe that the Palestinian cause was finding too much support with crucial segments of the American public, particularly within the media and on college campuses. So they set up an organization called EMET, E-M-E-T, an Educational Initiative Incorporated, Jesus, to offer Israel the kind of PR that the Israeli government seemed unable to provide itself. At first, EMET floundered without an executive director or a well-defined mission. But that changed after 9/11, and EMET changed, too, into what is now the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. The name is different, but the goal of influencing America's opinion-forming classes remains. What makes all this possible is the support the foundation receives from its billionaire backers. Its nearly $3 million annual budget comes from 27 major donors, most of whom are members of, quote, the study group, end quote, also sometimes called the mega group because of their sizable contributions, a semi-formal organization of major Jewish philanthropists who meet twice a year to discuss joint projects. The board of directors, Steve Forbes, Gene Kirkpatrick, and Jack Kemp. Advisors, Louis Free, R. James Woolsey, Newt Gingrich, Joe Lieberman. Board of advisors, Gary Bauer, Donna Brazil, Eric Cantor, Elliot Engel, Frank Gaffney, Mark Ginsburg, Charles Jacobs, Charles Krauthammer, Bill Kristol. Richard Lamb, former Colorado governor, Zell Miller, Richard Pearl, Steve Pomerantz, Charles Schumer. Previously listed were Mark Foley, he's gone, the Florida representative who just found too much pleasure in being a pedophile, J.D. Hayworth, who is running against McCain, and Frank Lautenberg. Senator. And if you want information, go to sourcewatch.org, sourcewatch.org, and look for FDD, or the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Isn't that nice? Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Wow. Donna Brazil? Maybe she's a spy. But it's astonishing, isn't it? Huh? This organization was put together to win American sympathy for Israel's response to the Palestinian Intifada, the second one. They believed that the Palestinian cause was finding too much support with segments of the American public, particularly within the media and on college campuses. Just never stops, does it? Never, never, never stops. It's like the oil eruption in the Gulf of Mexico. Oh, there's too much here. At one of the blog sites, John Cole writes, "Thank goodness that menace has been handled." He's referring to Helen Thomas. Helen Thomas announced on Monday that she's retiring moments after the White House Correspondents Association said it was considering stripping her of her front row press room seat. The 89-year-old so-called dean of the White House press corps had caused an uproar after making remarks in May suggesting that Israeli Jews should, quote, get the hell out of Palestine, end quote, and return to Germany and Poland or, quote, wherever they came from, end quote. Personally, I'm quite relieved that there is no one critical administration or Israeli policy left in the White House press corps. Not that there is any difference. All those pesky questions about Afghanistan and Iraq and human rights were kind of annoying and got into the way of more substantive stuff, such as questions like, can you talk about the criticism that the president isn't making that emotional connection with the people over the spill? Or, did anyone at the White House yell at him, BP's Hayward, for making those comments? I think our democracy will be stronger and more informed as a result of Helen Thomas being gone. If only she'd had the common sense to call them goat-effing child molesters. John Cole. Stick around. Laura Flanders, when we come back. If you're not, you should be. You can get a lot of information about Laura's program. Go to Grit, G-R-I-T, grittv.org. Hi, Laura.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you doing?
Well, you know, trundling along. Always happy to be here with you. I'm so sorry about what happened last time. I had 25 alarms this time.
No problem. No problem.
I never want to miss time with Mike. Do your listeners know how lucky they are to have you?
Oh, stop. Oh, my God.
You listen, in times like this, you can number on, I would say, one hand, the people, for example, on radio or TV this week, who are telling any kind of truth about what's happened with that flotilla in Gaza, or maybe raising some questions about the pylon of Helen Thomas. I mean, there's serious stuff going down in this country that is just being ignored.
At Grit TV, you have a posting there. You've got Norman Finkelstein, you've got Huwaida Araf, people who... Norman Solomon is another writer who are willing to tell the truth, who are compelled to tell the truth. And it's a shame. You know, I think about what happened to Helen Thomas. You've had conversations with her. I never have.
Yeah, I did. I mean, you know, let's be clear. It was a dumb, stupid thing she said. She's 89 years old. And when she got frustrated, pushed for the 93rd time about her thinkings about what should happen in Palestine, she said the Israelis should get out. She said the Jews should get out. That was her big mistake. And then she said, when asked where they should go, she said they should go back where they came from. And people said, what do you mean by that? And it was totally offensive. Germany, Poland, offensive, all right? But really, she apologized, she quit her job. There has been more outrage expressed in 24 hours against this formerly grand dame of the White House press corps than there has yet about the 9 men shot dead, multiple bullet wounds to the head by Israeli commandos in international waters when they were trying to challenge the aid blockade on Gaza. And, you know, a certain amount of outrage is due, but let's have even-handed outrage standards here. You had the White House coming out 24 hours saying, you know, less than 24 hours calling it reprehensible. How long did it take them to have anything sensible to say about British Petroleum after they destroyed the ecosystem of the Gulf Coast, let alone what happened to the flotilla last week?
Well, you know, one of the ways I look at her comments, Laura, she's been around forever. She goes back to the Kennedy years. And during that time, she's had a front row seat in these White House briefings, not just in the White House briefings, but when she worked for UPI before it got absorbed by this crazy cult, Mooney cult. And she has seen 50 years of refusal on the part of American politicians to ever come to the defense under any circumstances of the Palestinian people. No matter what atrocity is committed against them, no matter what happens, there is always a rationale. Dianne Feinstein today is calling for an investigation. But at the same time she calls for an investigation, she has to drag out Hamas. And whether you and I or the American public or whomever, the Israelis don't like Hamas, the Palestinians voted them into office.
And they were pushed to have those elections by Dick Cheney and crew.
That's right. And one of the reasons they were voted in was because the organization they replaced was totally ineffective. You know, Gaza has become a 60-year-old, well, let's just go back to 67, a 43-year-old concentration camp. Concentration in the sense of concentrated people. And so I can understand Helen Thomas. She, you know, she's approaching 90. I had a friend today say, well, it might have been a half-senile statement. I disagree. I disagree completely. I think that, yes, she might have been a little bit more judicious because she is, after all, a journalist, although she's a columnist now as opposed to a journalist. But I can understand where that comment came from.
Yeah.
And it's no different. I mentioned this on the program the other night. And got a lot of hate mail, which I really don't give a damn because I said it. But Meir Kahane, in his book They Must Go, said essentially the same thing about the Palestinians, that the Palestinians watched, Kahane's words, watched the Jew arrive from Kiev, from Philly, from Brooklyn, from Johannesburg, and the Palestinian understands that these people are here to take his land. And Kahane, of course, he was, as you know, assassinated in New York. But Kahane, in that book, They Must Go, made it very clear that he, as a member of the Chak Party and or the Koch Party, and as a member of the Israeli Knesset, completely believed that the Palestinians had to be pushed out. So I, you know, it just goes on and on.
It would be sad if people remember Helen Thomas only in this moment.
Right.
You know, this is the woman who doggedly, and I remember when you and I were on the air on the radio during that summer, that Cindy Sheehan was raising her question outside of George W.'s ranch, why did you send my son to war?
Right.
And everyone else who's gone. She's talking about Afghanistan. And basically, Helen Thomas was the only member of the White House press corps who day after day doggedly asked that question, and she was asking it again of this president.
Right.
As recently as this week, what are the troops doing in Afghanistan? When are they going to be back? Et cetera, et cetera. So again, for the White House Press Association to then, you know, berate her and bemoan and bewail what she had to say when they have not had really anything bad to say about the scores of journalists who did nothing but throw softball questions at George W. Bush for 8 straight years and then carry the government's lies in their newspapers that brought us into war. Again, what she said was offensive, particularly the reference to Germany and Poland, which many people remember as the home of the concentration camps. Was she saying sending them back to obliteration? Who knows? It was a stupid thing she said, but really some sense of proportion here, I think, is what we're calling for. But even that's been, you know, beyond the pale for discussion in the media this week.
I want to chat with you in a moment here about the situation in the Gulf of Mexico. But if you don't mind, this thing that's happening at Grit TV.
Yes, it's very exciting.
Yeah, tell us about it.
Well, you know, you're doing great here on commercial radio, but some of us have been going back into trying to figure out how can we have a non-commercial structure for what we do. Mm-hmm. How can we have a have no ads on the TV show that we do? So we don't do ads on our TV show, which is seen on Free Speech TV, Dish Network, Channel 9415, on satellite all over the country, as well as on cable stations, free community cable stations, no ads. Instead, we raise money from our viewers, and we have a pledge drive every year. And if you're familiar with public radio or television, you know what it's like. We go on the air and we say, you know, will you pledge to support the programming so we don't have to go cap in hand to British Petroleum?
Right.
And the people
you would never do.
You know, that's what you're driven to. Well, we got a match. We got a match from the Lannan Foundation, these fantastic people in Santa Fe, who said if you can raise $100,000 by the end of June, we'll match it 2-1.
Uh-huh.
So if we can raise that $100,000, it's no small feat to raise $100,000, but if we can do it, we'll get $200,000, and this will enable us to really build out our studio. You know that we have to leave Air America, find a new place. It needs, for example, really good soundproofing.
Mm-hmm.
It needs, well, we want to hire some investigative reporters. There's lots of things we want to do. We are, at this point, with everybody having helped, we are $200 away from the goal.
That's it.
And that's it. So if anybody wants to help out there, they just go to grittv.org. They can give online, or they can see the information about how to send a check and be part of building independent media, because much as we love MSNBC and the shows that occasionally appear in the commercial radio and television world, if we can control our own means of production, well, we know that's what really makes us independent and secure.
That is absolutely the truth. Hold on a second, would you, Laura?
Sure.
Okay, we got to take a break here. We'll be right back. We're talking to Laura Flanders. During the break, go to grittv.org. Just take a look. We'll be right back.
Inside your head. It's Mike Malloy.
It is 21 past the hour. We're talking with Laura Flanders from grittv.org. If you were a good listener, you went to the website during the break. If you were a bad listener, please go now, grittv.org, and find out what they're doing with this fundraising. Independent media, you know, we've been hearing that for a long time. Laura, I used to work for a newspaper here in Atlanta called the Great Speckled Bird. Is a radical voice from the South, and we considered ourselves to be independent, but it's different now. That was back in 1974, and it's to the point now where there is just media overload, and it's all corporate controlled, with a few exceptions. Hartman's program isn't. This program isn't. Stephanie's program isn't. Your program isn't. There are several that are not. But what you're trying to do with Grit TV, I think, is just incredibly important.
Yeah. I mean, I remember, I mean, the reason really that I began this project was I felt like we need to have a bench, you know, what do you call it, a bench head? No.
Benchmark?
Something. We need a place where, if necessary.
A beach head.
A beach head, that's the one. I forgot about what's happened to our beaches. I thought of benches.
Right.
But no, we need a beach head so that we can have a place that is free from corporate influence, that can attract audiences and remind audiences of who is out there.
Mm-hmm.
Because the great thing about TV these days is that it's much cheaper to produce than it used to be. It's still way more expensive than radio, and I don't recommend it.
Right.
But it is cheaper than it used to be, and because of the moment that we're in, we can make an impact, for example, on broadband with high-quality video that really can compete with the networks in a way that we never could before. So the idea is, in the same way that you're up against right-wing talkers on the radio dial and you catch some people by surprise and they think, wow, that's fresh, that's new. Well, so too, we can catch people as they're flipping the TV dial or they're surfing the web.
Mm-hmm.
And to be up there as we are on a few public television stations around the country, independently distributed, is another way too of having a little, you know, beachhead out there trying to reach those audiences that are otherwise just besieged. I mean, I was at the gym today, which is part of why I'm full of energy right now. And I was on the treadmill, the actual treadmill, not the one that we think we're on the rest of the day.
No, I got you.
And I was watching the TV, and literally, Mike, the reports on the BP oil spill, which isn't a spill, let's say, face it. It is a devastation.
The catastrophe.
The reports, on each side of the reports, were these $50 million BP ads.
Mm-hmm.
So the reporter has however long they have with whatever graphics they have to say there are some questions being raised about where are the cleanup crews. Meanwhile, BP has $50 million going into the glossiest, glamorous, most fancy-looking advertising that makes it look like there are hundreds of cleanup crews on every beach, everywhere you turn, courtesy of Tony Hayward because he's such a good guy.
Right.
And you just think, I think the other ad was for clean coal. You know, so you're trying to report on the future of the coal industry, and there are ads about clean coal coming.
Yeah, and safe nuclear energy.
Yeah, one of those AstroTurf phony corporate flak groups.
Mm-hmm.
And the last one was for an airline. So I thought, you know, here it is, really large. Our public airwaves, the television and radio airwaves, the public's possession, scarce resource. We lease them to people who then sell it to advertising and give us nothing back. These airwaves are a battleground, and
we're
really up against it.
Your term "beachhead" is well chosen because it is almost like it's a term from. I guess it has its origins in military tactics, but to establish a beachhead, to invade, to fight against the aggressor, whatever, you establish the beachhead, and that's pretty much what independent media has come down to. It's a constant struggle just to stay on the air, to stay with your television program, to stay, to find some place to publish. It's a constant battle, and I think beachhead is a good term. It conjures up to me the right image, trying to establish a toehold in enemy territory.
Yeah, no, it's exactly what it feels like.
Oh my God.
Exactly what it feels like. But luckily, you know, with people contributing to this pledge drive and the folks who are out there who care that listen to your show and Tom's and everybody's, we are, I think, spreading the word that there are alternatives that you can find and seek out to give you a different perspective on what's going on. Because I'm worried. If you just sat in front of your TV plugged into even MSNBC or CNN, whatever they're saying on the content, the advertising is just devastating.
That's what kills you. You know, to watch Rachel's program or Olbermann's program and then see some of the ads that they have to use, obviously, is pretty astonishing.
Yeah.
The contrast. All right, grittv.org. When does this thing end?
We've got till the 30th of June, and the really frightening part about it is that if we don't meet the match, we don't get any of it.
Will you stay in touch with Kathy? I say Kathy because she handles that part of it, and we'll put you back on as you get closer.
That would be great.
All right, let's do it again.
All right,
Laura Flanders, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us.
Thank you, Mike, and keep up the great work.
All right, take care.
Okay,
all right,
bye bye.
It's grit, G-R-I-T, TV.org, grittv.org. Laura also works with the Nation Institute, so check out grittv.org. All right? We'll be back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
For trying to change the system from where they are. I'm coming now. I'm coming to reward them. First, we take Manhattan. Then we take Berlin.
It's about 25 before the hour. All right. We have a report from our economic affairs correspondent, Bruce Enberg. Prairie 2. Oh, my God. I just blew this cover. It's Batman. No, it's Bruce Wayne. No, it's Batman. There was the usual economic news today, much the same as yesterday when the euro went to new lows against U.S. dollar. And this pushed down all the commodities priced in dollars except gold, which is close to a new high. Attacks against the debt of Portugal have picked up with another downgrade of their credit rating. And there are indications from the rating agencies that there would be more downgrades. These downgrades have nothing to do with the real situation on the ground, but rather an anticipation that Portugal will have a hard time issuing new debt in the bond market to replace expiring debt, largely because their credit rating has been downgraded, which cuts the number of investment funds that can buy bonds. Supply and demand sets the price in the so-called free market, and of course capitalists long ago caught on to controlling the supply and controlling the demand to their advantage. Hungary is close to slipping into the same debt abyss, and the feeling that this contagion is spreading is driving down paper of all sorts and boosting gold. Even U.S. Treasuries fell sharply yesterday, as they're being seen as not immune, with the last bond auction not being well attended, and more large sales are scheduled for this week. Japan is also issuing a record amount of debt for the new year that began in April. And this only adds to the rumor mill that we are all drowning in debt. We are drowning, but not from debt. Debt is just the flotsam and jetsam left from the sinking of the U.S. economy. 30 years of selling off America instead of manufacturing things to sell has long ago brought us to the point where all we have left to sell is debt. Securitized debt of all kinds, from subprime mortgages and credit card debt to junk bonds. It was all created and used to build up $1 quadrillion of derivatives. If the rest of the world didn't feel dependent on using the U.S. dollar as reserve currency, then we would all be in the dumpster already. This attack by Wall Street on the euro is all that is keeping things going, since U.S. dollars are still considered spendable for now. The rich, however, are all filling their personal vaults with gold. The FDIC spent $300 million closing banks this past Friday, as they do almost every Friday. Most weeks, these are banks in the heartland, where the real estate bubble is not a factor. It's failed commercial loans that are dragging these banks under. Most of it can be traced back to the Walmart plague. When they come into a town, they will take out 200 small businesses in a 40-mile radius and drive down wages. This drives down property values and erodes the tax base, and often Walmart will get tax exemptions from the town they choose for the center of their web. They use competition between towns to get what they want, since everybody knows all the other towns are really screwed. Every store they open gives them more leverage to force factory production to move to China, and the small factories in these towns close too. At some point, the Walmarts will close as well, and the Walton family will simply continue to live comfortably on their feudal estates. There's a new class of people in America, the so-called 99-weekers. Their unemployment is gone, and Congress is not going to pass an extension for any more weeks. They haven't yet funded the existing extensions for those with less than 99 weeks. To add insult to injury, the rat bastard corporations all have policies against hiring somebody from this class, as they see them as somehow damaged. We need to see these corporations as damaged and recreate an economy that works for all of us, and not just the 0.1% at the top, and no one else. Prairie2.com. Check out his website. Prairie 2 is starting to sound like a democratic socialist. No, couldn't be. Good at Bruce. And since we're right here, also a report card from Kay Petrini, our education affairs correspondent, that's been sitting here for a week. Hi, Mike. On a recent program, you mentioned the concept of learned helplessness in relation to German citizens at the time of Hitler's rise to power. When I heard this, I immediately thought of the work of Stanford historian Gordon Craig, who framed the issue as the Germans' quote, unquestioning deference to authority, end quote. Craig maintained that because Germans had historically lived under authoritarian governments, they were not ready to embrace the democracy of the Weimar Republic at the start of the 20th century. Given the events of the past decade, I think his analysis can also be applied to the United States in the 21st century. Quote, Germany entered the 20th century without the kind of tradition that might have enabled it to meet the hard problems that were awaiting it. This was a problem that worried many thoughtful Germans. After the First World War, a conflict that was due in large part to the absence in Germany of effective constitutional restraints upon the arbitrary use of power, the philosopher and theologian Ernst Troeltsch sought to come to terms with it. In a lecture entitled The Ideas of Natural Law and Humanity in World History, he addressed what he called the problem of the difference between the German system of ideas in politics, history, and ethics and that of Western Europe and America. The basis of Western political thinking, he argued, was the view of all men forming a single society and being governed by a common law. But this had never in modern times been congenial to the German mind. In England and America, the idea of natural law had inspired the demand for personal liberty and for the right of the people to control the leaders they had themselves chosen. In France, it had become a theory of direct self-government, equality, and full participation in the control of the state. Such ideas had never taken root in Germany, largely because of the failure of the Enlightenment in Germany and the subsequent rejection of the universal egalitarian ethic, the spirit of science of Western Europe, and a conception of natural law. Instead of these Western ideas, the Germans had emphasized the inner development of the individual and of the German nation as a unique cultural expression. Their downright obsession with this made them indifferent to the Western view that human beings and nations should seek, on the basis of equality, to increase the range of reason, well-being, liberty, and purposeful organization until they attain the goal of the unity of mankind. At the same time, the Germans' inward directedness had induced them to leave the practical realities of existence and the decisions affecting the life and well-being of ordinary people in the control of the state and its agents. End quote. The ultimate irony is that as we have entered the 21st century, Germany is much more of a small-d democratic nation than the United States. When the German government does something the people don't like, the people take to the streets. When an election is held, upwards of 70% of German citizens vote. When you talk to the average German citizen, you discover that he or she is aware of what is going on in Germany and around the world. Contrast this with the United States, where during 8 years of criminality under the Bush administration, we did nothing. Where even in a presidential election, barely half of all eligible voters vote. Where the average American citizen knows very little about his leaders and the decisions they are making and is utterly clueless when it comes to what is going on in the rest of the world. Professor Craig also wrote, and I'm paraphrasing, the Weimar Republic failed because there was a dearth of Democrats. End quote. I would say that today the American Republic is treading dangerously close to failure, and for the very same reason. K. You can pick up Kay Petrini's writings at Kay's Report Card, K-A-Y-S, kaysreportcard.com. I have what appears to be a correction of a correction. Oh, my God. Apparently, Charles Schumer was part of the original group of signatories at PNAC. I know this because I have been sent a copy of the original signatories and then the 25 added signatories, among whom is Charles Schumer. And I was sent it in order to clear up what is apparently an unclear-upable situation. Oh, my God. So our correction from last night is now corrected. And Charles Schumer was one of the original signatories to the Project for a New American Century. Crime family that decided to wage endless war for endless profit. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Everybody knows. Everybody knows the boat is leaking. Everybody knows the captain lied. Everybody got this broken feeling. Like their father or their dog just died. Everybody talking.
With the truth. It's more Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour. Does the name Sue Loudon mean anything to you? She is the woman running for the United States Senate in Nevada, former Nevada state senator. And our military affairs correspondent, Sharon Gordy, sent this to me. It's from vetvoice.com. While serving in the Nevada State Senate, Sue Loudon, she's the chicken lady, the one that suggested that you pay for your doctor bills with chickens. Sue Loudon backed a bill that would have taxed veterans for their own burials in veterans' cemeteries. Now, I've told you before on this program that all Republicans hate soldiers. They use them. Republicans use the military as a prop, as a backdrop. Even Republicans, and there are very few, who have served in the military. In so many of those instances, the Republicans that served in the military were cowards, like John McCain. But all Republicans hate the military. They only use them. It's a weird kind of hate. It's a suck-up hate. They want people to think, oh, yeah, I'm real pro-military, when the only thing Republicans want the military to do is to pose around them when they're running for office. So Republican Sue Loudon had backed a bill that would have taxed veterans for their own burials. Now, as VetVoice.com reported, the sensible thing for Loudon to do would be to admit she was wrong. Absent that, she should probably just keep her mouth shut about it. But obviously, sense avoids Sue Loudon, as yesterday she was still defending her radical anti-veteran agenda. On a hastily arranged conference call with reporters, Loudon defended her decision to propose a $100 fee on non-combat veterans seeking to be buried in military cemeteries. When she chaired the State Senate Taxation Committee, she said, quote, I had to balance our state budget. Part of the balancing process was charging a fee to certain vets in order to be buried in our state's veteran cemeteries, end quote. Wow. Son of a bitch. When Sue Loudon decided it was her single-handed duty to balance the budget for the state of Nevada, she thought the best way to do that was on the backs of dead veterans, just like Sean Hannity. Sean Hannity, who decided that one of the quickest ways to make a lot of money and to scam people is to do it on the backs of the widows and orphans of dead veterans, dead soldiers, dead Marines. Hannity with his freedom concerts, or whatever the hell they were called. So Sue Loudon, running for the Senate on the Republican for the Republican nomination for Senate, and Sean Hannity are cut from the same cloth. They despise veterans and their families. They spit on them. They treat them like dirt. The only time Republicans, including a cheeseball like Sean Hannity, wants to associate himself or herself, in the case of Sue Loudon, with the military is when they can use the military. When they can use a soldier or a flag-draped coffin or a military cemetery as a prop. Bastards. Filthy, filthy bastards. And yet, stupid right-wingers, well, stupid Republicans who go vote for these people. Yeah, I love America. No, you don't. You sorry bastard. You have been so brainwashed you couldn't find your ass with both hands anymore. You got to see the emails I get. God. New York Times reporting on their website, and it'll be in tomorrow's paper. Plumes of oil deep in the Gulf are spreading far, raising fresh concerns about the potential impact of the spill on sea life. I don't need to be a professor or a journalist to make it very clear. The effects of this oil spill is the murder of the Gulf of Mexico. It's over. It is over. Tests conducted by research at the University of South Florida found that the concentrations of oil-related chemicals in the water were generally low. Still, the test confirmed that toxic compounds that would normally be expected to evaporate from the surface in a shallow water oil spill were instead spreading through the ocean in the Deepwater Horizon leak. Today, I saw a bit of a press conference. The head of NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the head of that woman, what's her name? Jane Lubchenco. And she was doing a press conference along with the Coast Guard Admiral Allen. And I watched a bit of it on CNN and MSNBC and then switched over to get away from the hideous commercials, switched over to C-SPAN. And watched this press conference for a while. And then just for the hell of it, I switched over to Fox News to see if they were covering it. Of course not. They were talking about the Vandersloot murder case off in a different country. And it is, you know, you got to wonder why sometimes, I guess, you wonder why Fox television viewers are so abysmally stupid and ignorant and easily led around by their slack cheek jaw, their slack jaw, their slack jaw, I don't know, by their noses, by their asses, whatever. And then you realize what constitutes programming at this Fox television sewer. We'll be back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. past the hour. This is the Malloy program. I'm going to share with you some emails I got regarding last night's program, but this was just sent to me. It's from from the Guardian of the UK. Is that right? I guess so. Israel is ready to accept a British plan to ease its blockade of Gaza in exchange for international acceptance of a watered-down investigation into last week's deadly raid on a Turkish aid ship, according to sources in the UK. Britain is understood to have taken a leading role in the negotiations and last week circulated a confidential document proposing ways of easing the blockade. Facing growing international criticism over the humanitarian situation in Gaza, Israeli officials said they would agree, in principle, to permit the passage of substantially more aid through Israel's land crossings with the Hamas-controlled territory. Israeli officials denied there was any direct link between their willingness to cooperate over the blockade and the apparent ebbing of Western support for a UN-led international inquiry into the flotilla raid. But a Western source close to international discussions with Israel said, quote, a quid pro quo deal is in the offing, end quote. So there you go. See, the rest of the world is always willing, aren't they, on some level to make a deal with outlaws. In this particular case, the Likudniks in Israel. There will be no investigation. If there is one, it will be very watered down. It will be, I think, profuse in its insistence that this was planned and staged by Hamas or Iran or Turkey deliberately to provoke the poor, benighted Israelis and the Israeli Defense Forces by using unarmed civilians as bait. And in exchange for that, the Israelis will show their grand humanity by easing, not ending, but easing the restriction. Now, The Guardian, the UK, says... they're referring to Hamas here. Since the Islamist group seized control in 2007, Israel has allowed only basic humanitarian supplies into Gaza. Blah, blah, blah. Seized control? I thought they were voted in. Oh, damn. Do I have this entirely wrong? Quick, somebody send me an email. I was under the impression that they had elections... and in Gaza, Hamas won, and the elections were forced by the Bushes and the Cheneys. Gee, have I been wrong for 3 years? Part of the British proposal includes Israel abandoning its official list of 35 items whose entry into Gaza is allowed, only 35, in favor of a list of specifically outlawed items. In other words, instead of telling us only 35 you'll let in, tell us what you won't let in. Oh, my God. Okay. Last night I asked the question, does any country have an inherent right to exist? Israel claims the right to exist and demands that most of the rest of the world acknowledge this right to exist. I can't think of another country that demands that the rest of the world acknowledge, not Japan, not Lebanon, not Ecuador, not Greenland. I mean, there is a desire to exist, I guess, or a inclination to exist, or a willingness to exist, but a right to exist? So Tom in Maryland writes, Mike, in regards to your question, who would claim a God-given right to exist and demand that others acknowledge that God-given command? I know of a group who would do that. The Bene Gesserits of Frank Herbert's Dune would do that. Now hear me out and please don't think I'm just another crazy person. In the novel, the Bene Gesserits are masters of social architecture, manipulation, eugenics, and most of all politics. Within the Bene Gesserits is a group known as the Missionaria Protectiva. Their purpose is to disseminate religion among the uneducated, as well as educated alike, in order to, over time, control large segments of an interplanetary empire. They realize the effectiveness of religion as a tool, as do most of the true power players in politics. What we have here in the world today is a confused populace, one that is torn between believing an ancient and successful mass brainwashing attempt that has spanned centuries, or the acceptance of the fact that it was all made up in order to take us to war with our fellow man for some sociopath's meager ambitions. Meager is what they are, which is why Israel will never be at peace. Such petty squabbles are not worthy of victory. I mean, come on. This is a tiny piece of land which, in the not-so-distant future, will cease to exist due to natural or man-made forces. F it. This is all just madness. Tom in Maryland. Jack. Dear Mike, I agree with everything you've been saying about Israel. However, you constantly refer to, quote, American Jews, end quote, standing pat behind Israel. Now, I know that you have to paint with a broad brush, but there are many, many American Jews, including myself, I'm a Jew by birth, atheist by conviction, that are fiercely critical of Israeli policies. I would suggest a recent article by Peter Beinart in the New York Review of Books, titled The Failure of the American Jewish Establishment, that goes into this issue. Of course, his criticism of Israel immediately triggered a Pavlovian reaction by Abraham Foxman, head of the EDL. Keep doing what you're doing. The tide is turning, however slowly. Jack and his last name. Bonnie writes, as I was driving home tonight, this would be last night, I heard your voice in the wilderness confirming my views on our country's outrageous sucking up to Israel. I had dinner with friends, all atheists. You'd think they'd be open-minded, but no chance. My defense of Helen Thomas was shouted down, drowned out. How can people be so blind? Whenever I write a letter on the subject to the editor of the L.A. Times, I always sign it blank, 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 because I don't want anyone coming after me. In 1985, Alex Oda, an Arab-American peace activist, had his office in the same building as my law firm in Santa Ana, California. He opened his office door one fine morning and was blasted dead away by a pre-planted bomb. The JDL, the Jewish Defense League, was suspected, but of course the investigation went nowhere. And to this day, the case has never been solved. Subsequently, his memorial statue was even vandalized. Just imagine how all this would have been handled if he'd been Jewish. Signed, and her name. Yeah, I remember the Alex Oda case. Dr. Stephen writes from Seattle. We got a break here? All right, we have a break. Stephen is an Orthodox Jew in the Pacific Northwest. I'll share with you what he had to say. Some of these emails are very interesting, and some of them were just absolutely poison. Just poison. Poison. But that's the way it goes. All right, we... Blanche Lincoln is making her her victory speech in the Democratic primary. Is that right? That was a primary. She barely squeaked by. That's a shame. All right, music maestro, stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
listen to Right Wing Radio. Here's Mike Malone.
21 past the hour. Dr. Stephen writes, "Hi, Mike. As you may recall, I'm an Orthodox Jew in the Pacific Northwest. I don't claim to be a Jewish scholar, nor do I unequivocally accept everything I'm fed. Regarding the stories in the Talmud, and to many of my community's surprise, I don't equivocally, unequivocally accept the, quote, story of Israel, end quote, and its, quote, right to exist, end quote. You have bravely stood your ground on this issue since I started listening to you all those years ago at WLS in Chicago. I was not a supporter of your words back then, but as my views have crystallized over time, I'm certainly more in line with the notion of fairness to all people. I count myself as one of your truth seekers looking for the truth, no matter what my underlying emotions are about a subject. Helen Thomas is a true national treasure, and she's one of the brightest bulbs this nation has had the privilege to hear from. I'm of the mindset that this true American patriot is not just caving to the agenda of the powers that be. I just don't see her doing that, having stood up to the White House press corps, having stood up in the White House press corps and ostensibly calling Bush 43 a liar to his face. She wasn't fired then. But when she spoke her mind in late May, notice the date, she said this was prior to the commando raid on the Gaza flotilla, but only publicized after Israel commandeered the ship, killing multiple people in the process. When she spoke her mind in late May, the backlash and fury seems to have resulted in her dismissal. I have no doubt that Helen Thomas was asked to step down. I just don't believe she bowed to the powers that be without calculating its effect carefully. You see, Helen Thomas may have spoken her mind candidly about her beliefs around Middle East policy and justice. I also believe she stepped down at a time when the world was looking at her as an icon in American journalism. And that's when she showed her last, arguably most courageous act, that speech is not free here in the good old U.S. of A. Keep it lit, Mike. Thanks for sticking to your truth. Steve in Seattle. Epi 10. See if I can read this. He writes, I think it's he. I know the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is infinitely complicated and will never be solved as long as religion exists on this planet. But, stripped of all the politics, isn't it basically just a 3,000-year-old family feud based on the fairy tale of Abraham effing his maid and throwing out the maid and the kid, was it Ishmael? I don't know, into the wilderness or some effing thing. And because effing Abraham heard an effing voice in his effing head telling him he'd have an effing son to lead Israel, he and his supposedly infertile effing wife Sarah then kicked the maid and legitimate kid out on their effing butts. Do I have it right? I don't effing know. I don't effing care. I'm just asking. Then doesn't the story go on that effing Isaac became the Jewish bloodline and effing Ishmael became the Arab bloodline? Do I have that effing right? Or is that what this blank's about? An effing 3,000-year-old schizophrenic that couldn't keep his blank in his pants. And to make matters worse, it's all just an effing made-up effing fairy tale to boot. Is it really just an effing family feud over an effing fairy tale? This insane planet is so effed up. If I ever find the intergalactic subway off this hellhole, I'll save you a seat. F. Happy 10. Well, that's the story of Abraham. Certainly told in a way I've never heard it told before, right? I mean, Abraham finally comes to some kind of a weird delusional realization that there's not lots and lots and lots of gods. There's only one out there in the desert. And how does this demonic god reward him? Bring me your son. Let me kill your son. But crazy. Religion is psychosis. It is complete break with reality. It is the underlying cause of everything that is painful and miserable on this planet. Everything. Abraham. We have a break, and we shall return. There's a few more of these emails I want to share with you. And then we'll move on to something even more fun. How's that? Okay? Does that ring your chimes? Okay. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Resistance Radio with Mike Malloy.
It is 25 before the hour.
The traffic lights, they turn.
Couple more here. I was listening to your program yesterday. This is Chris in Helena, Montana. I was listening to your program yesterday, and I wonder how you would propose to deal with Israel. I can understand questioning the UN decision to form the State of Israel, but it is done. 62 years passed. What now? So you think that the whole nation is illegitimate? If so, what would you suggest to do? And don't you think that there is a double standard in dealing with Israel and other countries? If people from Gaza are justified in shooting at Israel because Israel took their land and they are fighting for what is legitimately theirs, would it be justified for Mexicans to shoot at California or Germans at Western Poland? How about Native Americans at a suburb in, say, Minneapolis? I probably just don't understand. Otherwise, I like your show, Chris. I guess you could find a moral justification regarding the Mexicans and the Germans and the Native Americans, Chris. As far as what to do now, there's two ways to do this, I think. First of all, the so-called two-state solution. If the Israelis agree to return to the boundaries as laid out by the UN mandate that established the State of Israel, it would reduce the territory that Israel has seized from the Palestinians by probably 70%. If the Israelis would abide by UN Resolution 242 that called for the return to the boundaries prior to the 1967 war, then Israel would have about half this tiny little land strip, and the Palestinians would have the other. But I have read some histories of the early, written by Jews, by the way, of the early establishment of the State of Israel and the behind-the-scenes chicanery that was going on. It was never the intent of the founders of Israel to share anything with anybody. They had what they called Eretz Israel, I believe I'm pronouncing it right, Greater Israel, which extended the entire length. The biblical Israel had nothing to do with Palestinians or Hittites or Greeks or Romans or anybody else. It had to do with this crazy story of a cloud being saying to people, here, I give you this. So a two-state solution is one, or a two-state resolution is one solution. The other solution would be a one-state solution, where the Palestinians would have to agree to this, as would the Israelis, so it'll never happen. But the idea that Israel, and in order to do number the second idea here, Israel would give up its status as a as an Israel or as a Jewish state, and that solution is not a solution. That idea would be a one-state so-called solution, where the Jews and the Muslims, the Sephardic and Ashkenazim and the Semites and everybody would just live together. And the Jews who wanted to migrate there would feel a closeness to their God creature. And the Muslims who wanted to live there would feel a closeness to their God creature. And the Christians who wanted to live there or come and visit their holy places would feel a closeness to their God creature. But that will never happen. So that's the best I can do. And Chris, like you, I probably just don't understand. GR, Hopi in Arizona, writes, how in the hell does Israel get to attack unprovoked ships of other sovereign nations on the high seas, kill 20 people, kidnap the rest, commandeer private property, and not end up essentially in a state of war? Under longstanding international maritime law, the actions of Israel against the ships of the Gaza Relief Convoy are indeed an open act of warfare on the high seas. Do you feel the top spinning just a little faster today, Mike? I do. And Malachi in Saskatoon. This evening, before your show, I heard an Israeli spokesman state that, quote, Hamas took over in a coup d'etat, end quote. These are the insidious lies they are putting forth. Hamas is the duly elected government, as verified by international observers of Gaza. And Bruce writes, regarding this question that I had the other night, who has the right to exist? Bruce writes, there is an historical parallel to the, quote, right to exist, end quote, demand of Israel. And that would be the Manifest Destiny movement in the U.S., which put forth that the United States had a right to exist and conquer anybody they chose and enslave them or eradicate any indigenous people who got in their way. This right was theirs by divine fiat. Today, the descendants of these people can be found in PNAC, Project for a New American Century, or the residual of that organization, who believe the entire world is their manifest destiny. Point taken. We don't have a lot of time, but Kathy, do you want to release the lines and let's take some phone calls? A whole bunch of stuff I'll never get to tonight, but that's the way it goes in the wonderful world of radio. 877-996-2556 is the number if you would like to call in. 877-996-2556. Email from BC about the email I got from the guy who epi-10, every other word was the F word. And BC writes, Mike, could you effing forward that effing email about the effing Abraham story to me? I'd effing appreciate it. No, I get your point. Oh, my God. Well, and a lot of people are emailing that Blanche Lincoln won. This emailer says Blanche Fatass just won. All right. now we're starting to hear that that her campaign stole the election by the foul use of the voting machines, by jiggering the voting machines. There were like 30 voting machines in her opposition's district until today. With 100-degree heat, there were two. Oh, God. Yeah, well, you know, when the power wants somebody elected, the power will get that person elected. Some of these people leave it alone. Some of the corporate controllers leave these stupid little local elections alone. By local, I mean who winds up in Congress, because once they get there, no matter who they are, they can be bought. But some of the elections, the corporatists, the capitalists decide, now let's make sure we get the right person. And apparently, there's the idea now that that's what happened with Blanche Lincoln's opponent. Blue is calling from Mumbai, India. Hello, Blue.
Yeah, good day, Mike.
How you doing?
Well, I'm great. How are you doing?
Not very well. Things are not going too well here in the United States of America.
Well, that's what I was talking to Cap about. Many of us in Australia, at least, are frankly appalled at the cowardice and the stupidity of the American people putting up with what they put up with.
Yeah, yeah.
But what I really called about was something that that sort of ties in indirectly with all of that. Yesterday, I was in the state of Uttar Pradesh, which is in the northeast of India.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a friend of mine up there who flies for another airline, and he lives in near the city of Kanpur. And so we flew up there, and he said, look, he and his wife said, look, we've got something we want you to see.
Mm-hmm.
And so we drove out to a village outside of Kanpur, and what was happening was...
Can you hold that, Blue, can you hold that thought?
Yeah, sure.
Hold it right there. Let me do this break, and we'll come back.
Yeah.
We're outside this village and what you found there, so just pick it up there when we come back, all right?
Right.
All right, hold on. It's 10 before the hour. We're talking with Blue, who's called in from Mumbai, India. All right, you are in the northeast part of the country?
Yeah, right. Well, Mike, it was one of the most remarkable things I've ever seen in my life. I didn't know anything about this until the other day. What happened was there were several of these merchants in this town that had been taking advantage of their female employees, cheating them, not paying them their wages and so on, and sexually exploiting them and threatening them with all kinds of physical mayhem and so on if they told anyone about it. And the authorities weren't doing anything about it. The police and the regional authorities were basically you know, absent without leave. And so my friend said, look, just watch what's going to happen. And so in about 20 minutes after we arrived, a group of about 20 women arrived, all dressed in these dark pink saris. Mm-hmm. I'm getting an echo. Are you there?
No, we're here. You're coming.
Okay.
Coming through fine.
So this group of about 20 women arrive, and they're all carrying these bamboo batons. They call them lathis in India, I think. And they confronted these guys, four or five of them. And I, of course, don't speak, you know, whatever language they were speaking there. I don't think it's Hindi in Uttar Pradesh, but in any event,
Urdu.
They were no, I don't think it's Urdu.
No.
But in any event, they were harassing these guys, and they were saying, "Look, you know, what the hell is going on?" And they were basically being very offensive. These men were being very offensive.
Right.
And these women simply took the lathis, the batons, and they pounded these drongos into the ground like so many tent pegs. And they said, look, you know, if this ever happens again, if we hear of this sort of thing happening again, we're going to come out and do it again, and we may do worse. And I thought, how fantastic that these people, these women, took matters into their own hands after the delegated authorities had failed to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, look, we're going to put an end to this kind of thing. And my friends had known that they were coming. That's the reason we drove out there. They knew that they were coming. And apparently now, in Uttar Pradesh at any rate, if these bastards, these men who are molesting women and so on, know that the Gulabis are coming, that's enough usually to straighten them out, but not apparently with these with this bunch. But I thought, you know, this is what's so necessary right now in the United States.
Yeah.
If you had a bunch of Gulabis descending on the White House, on the headquarters of BP, on the Supreme Court, you know, things might be a little different.
Yeah, they might. On the other hand, it may just set off, you know, this is, I realize we're not nearly as multilingual and multicultural as India. And plus we have, one third the population, but, you know, the spark necessary to set things aflame in this country, it would take much less. The Muslims and the Hindus are always killing each other in huge numbers in India, and somehow the country manages to lurch forward. Then you have Kashmir and so on and so on. The United States.
But the point is,
go ahead.
If I could interject, Mike.
Yeah.
The point is, people do something. They take matters into their own hands. If their government fails them, and if their corporations fail them, they do something about it. They take matters into their own hands.
I understand, and there was probably a time in this country when that would have worked. It may still work, but we are terrified in this country. You get 400 or 500 people together to call a strike against a company that may be not paying them adequately, and we have laws on the books in this in the United States now. The USA Patriot Act, number 2, which says that those strikers, those people, looking for, whatever it is they're looking for, can be charged with terrorism. So.
Well, I'm aware of that, and that's appalling. It's absolutely appalling.
Well, that has kind of a wet blanket effect on people who normally would take to the streets or would, let the authorities, whoever they are, corporate or government or law enforcement, let them know this far and no further. But so many people in this country, Blue, are terrified now that these laws are on the books and they will be enforced. We're almost out of time. Let me just put this in here. In the United States, we are about a half step from a fascist form of government. It may appear to be a representative, but so did Mussolini's government. We are so close to fascism in this country. Australia is not there. New Zealand is not there. As a matter of fact, you all seem to be going in the other direction. But the United States is so close to fascism that so many people in this country become immobilized with fear. That's the only thing I can come up with, Blue.
Well, I think you're right. Look, I was I was telling Kath, you folks have got to go see that Swedish film, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
You know, it's playing at a theater not far from where we live, and we are going to try to do it. Hey, listen, we're flat out of time. Thanks, Blue.
All right, Mike.
All right, appreciate you checking in. Take care. Take care. Hey. We are out of time. If you're on hold, I'm sorry. I asked for the phone calls, and then we don't get to you. But we'll do it tomorrow night. We've got to have a night this week, Kathy, where we just do phone calls. Let's try that tomorrow night. Do we have anybody on? No guests tomorrow? All right. Maybe we'll do that tomorrow night. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.
Jim Cook.